Before I get started this week, I wanted to give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a highly respected and heart-centered stress and TMS coach based in Los Angeles. She was a burnt-out high school teacher who battled chronic TMS symptoms for over 16 years. So she definitely gets the frustration of doing everything to heal and still not getting the results that you desire. It's important to note that while hard work, grit, and perseverance have driven many of our successes in life, relying solely on this masculine approach is unlikely to solve our TMS symptoms. The way out isn't through more hustle and push. Embracing concepts like surrender and ease and feeling our emotions can be incredibly challenging, especially when relying solely on our masculine energy has served us so well in the past. That's why working with a coach like Jeannie can make the difference, because healing comes from letting go, not by doing more. I encourage you to go to jeanniecolwin.com, that's JeannieColwin.com, to book your free call and learn about her one-on-one coaching program. Welcome back to the show. As you are listening to this, it is Wednesday, July the 24th. Thank you so much for being here. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Like I mentioned, as you're listening to this, I'm currently riding around Vancouver Island with my buddies on our annual motorcycle trip. If you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, we've done an annual trip every year since 2019, and this year is no different. So this time, we are taking our talents to Vancouver Island. But I'm excited for you to hear this interview I've got with Dr. Sinead DeFore. You can read a lot about her. I'm going to put a few links in the show notes, but I would encourage you to go check out her Instagram page, which is dr.sinead, and check her out on Instagram. She's got a lot of great content, but it was recommended to speak with her by a patient of hers who's a listener to this podcast. Don't know if I can say her name, but you know who you are. Dr. DeFore is an associate clinical professor in the Faculty of Health Science at McMaster University. She teaches and conducts research in the schools of medicine, nursing, and rehabilitation science. She completed her Master of PT at McMaster University in 2003 and her PhD in health and rehabilitation science at Western in 2011 and returned to McMaster to complete a postdoctorate fellowship. Her current research interests include conservative approaches to manage pelvic floor dysfunction, pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, and interprofessional collaborative practice methods of service provision to enhance pelvic health and pain science. So we talk a lot about pregnancy and a lot of the things that might be going on behind the surface or under the surface when we're talking about women who have first pregnancies versus second pregnancies and pelvic health in general. So this is a really fascinating interview. She has a couple of ways of putting things that are light years ahead of things that I've thought of or heard before in the field. So I'm excited for you to listen to us. Again, this is Dr. DeFore and I on the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. I have a guest with me today, Dr. Sinead DeFore out of Oakville, Ontario. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, first off, thank you for being here. I told you a little off air, but it was recommended that I talk to you because a listener of the show had recently come across some of your work and then was able to get in and see you. And it sounds like she just thinks the world of you. And so I thought I got to have Dr. DeFore on the podcast. So thanks for being here.
Okay, awesome. Thank you for inviting me. I look forward to our chat.
Yeah, for sure. So the reason that she had kind of mentioned, hey, this is a good person to chat with is I haven't had like a medical expert come on that specializes in pelvic pain or pelvic health that has any amount of mind-body approach in what they talk about or what some of their background is. And so that's what I want to know about from you. But maybe before we start, just give us some of the background on, maybe we'll start with what you're doing today and kind of what your role is in the medical world and the education world. And then we'll go back to how you got there and why you chose this line of work.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would call myself an academic clinician. So that's sort of where the doctor part comes. I'm a professor at McMaster University. I teach in the School of Rehabilitation Science and the School of Medicine. But then clinically, I'm actually a pelvic health physiotherapist. So that's my clinical role. I've been a physio for about a decade, But the last kind of 12 years, it's been really around sort of perinatal care, kind of pregnancy, postpartum, and pelvic health. There's additional training that you have to get to sort of focus in on that area. And really, I was drawn into that area, like many of us, actually, after I myself got pregnant with twins and was kind of navigating this world that there's clearly lots of room for improvement. And unfortunately, our sort of standard frontline medical system really doesn't address these issues very well, unfortunately. You know, I'm fortunate to teach in the family medicine program at McMaster, so I'm able to kind of teach some of the stuff in the curriculum to the docs. But really and truly, when it comes to pelvic health or the pelvic floor or pelvic pain, you know, our frontline care is a couple of decades behind pain science. And so anyways, I've become quite passionate about this topic. And that's why I love jumping on podcasts like this, just to get the word spread a bit faster. So,
Do you have any hypothesis of why has it kind of been largely ignored as being, and not to say like, you know, it feels like pain science is sort of a revolution of the last 10 or 15 years, at least when I look. Right. I mean, we have like the Sarno books from the 80s and the 90s, and he mentions in a movie that there was a lot of papers and journals that were done in like the 30s and 40s. But for the most part, I had not heard of it until 2017. Like it's been, you know, it's been 7 or 8 years now at that point. But this topic in particular, you had said, is kind of largely ignored. Why do you think that is, if you have any guess?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a little bit more of uptake in the pain science piece and kind of other forms of chronic pain or persistent pain. But when it comes to the pelvis, there's just this knee-jerk reaction to really want to think of it either structurally or mechanically, or think about it kind of from like a gynecological perspective or kind of these other perspectives where it gets siloed off into these other things. When actually really the main tenets of pain science hold, like generally we're talking about sort of nociplastic pain in this area.
Yeah.
So it's really, really interesting, but I think that's one of the stumbling blocks.
I mentioned I didn't know about pain science at all until about 2017. And now that you're saying that, one of the things that is coming to me is, back when I was kind of like in the abyss of pain for a variety of different ways in the like mid 2010s, there was videos that kept popping up for me in my YouTube algorithm about pelvic health and pelvic pain, but it was entirely about muscle imbalances throughout the midsection and the trunk. Can you talk about that? And the remedies in a lot of those was stretch this, strengthen that. And that's really the secret sauce to it and what you do. Can you talk about some of that? Maybe some, and I don't see a lot of those videos anymore. It might be because I'm not searching for them, but they also just might've been debunked in the last little while. You talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I think that's actually a really good place for us to start. You're quite right. When it comes to the pelvis, there are these long-standing notions that pain experienced in this part of the body is because of some type of imbalance, right? Because of course we have our two sacroiliac joints at the back. And so things function on a bit of a rotation axis through the pelvis. And then there's a lot of discourse around the concept of like having like a leg length discrepancy potentially.
Yep.
So there's a lot of narrative around sort of these mechanical reasons for pain. And to be fair, it's a reasonable hypothesis, right? It's reasonable to think if these structures kind of get tilted or compromised or everything's not balanced evenly, and then our motor output isn't optimal, there's compression here. It's a reasonable hypothesis, to be fair. The trouble in it is it actually has been disproven, right? So the fact that you're not seeing this as much is a very, very good thing. Where I sit, I would say that we still see these narratives though, and it's very, very frustrating. And actually I would say it's honestly a problem. Like it really is harmful, is actually with women when they're pregnant. And so there's still very much is this narrative that when you have pain pop up through your pelvis, right? So through that region of your body, when you're pregnant, surely this has to do with the hormone relaxin, and it's like overshot somehow and made your system too relaxed and actually too loose. And now you're unstable. So when you know, walking or you're kind of changing positions and you have some sensitivity through your pelvis, surely this is a dangerous situation because it means it's unstable. And again, like a bit of a plausible hypothesis, but it has been disproven. And these narratives go on and on and on, and they make these women incredibly, as you can appreciate, fearful, mm-hmm. you know, fearful to move, fearful to think, how on earth am I going to birth my baby through this pelvis that's like deranged and it's not in the right position and it's unstable. So we still are dealing with some of this incorrect narrative. And I would say it really lands in this space of perinatal care, which is like mostly where I live from a research perspective and clinically.
How, so one challenge that occurs a lot in a lot of the doctors and the physios and the different people in the medical field that I talk to, one thing that they often have to overcome with people that have the back pains and the shoulder pains and the foot pains and all that is just simply having a belief that any thought of this being anatomical is incorrect and that it is a mind body problem. I feel like that would, and I think you're going to agree with me, I feel like that notion with a pregnant woman is astronomically magnified because now they're talking about, you know, their body is in a completely different state of disarray, is not the right term, but I remember my wife, we've got two daughters, and like there's so many changes that happen so fast that to me, I feel like if I were a pregnant woman, that it's very plausible to think that there is something anatomically that's the issue here. And maybe there's not really a reference point of people that you've worked with for this that are not in perinatal care, but how do you overcome that? Like, how do you convince them that, hey, like this doesn't necessarily mean that it's an anatomical problem or there's a certain hormone that has way overshot on you? Like, what are some of the things and some of the ways and some of the tools in your toolbox that you use to help women overcome that?
Yeah. So it's a great question. So I'm fortunate to be fair because I'm an academic clinician. So mm-hmm. I'm very, very steeped in the literature. Like I have it at my fingertips. So to be fair, I'm quite pragmatic with people and say, look, this is what we used to think. It was a reasonable hypothesis. It's literally been disproven. And I will show them the data, right? So I'm kind of quite clear with that. And I'll help people to understand, look, if this was actually an issue to do with too much relaxin, wouldn't every single woman have this issue? Mm-hmm. They don't. If this was an issue that had to do with relaxin or the pregnancy, even maybe with some type of predisposition a mother had, wouldn't we see it the same in all of her pregnancies? We don't. We see this as an issue much more likely in the second pregnancy, not the first, and so on and so on. And so really the data is quite clear, and all the risk factors that have been established for this issue really point to the fact that, look, this isn't actually about the pregnancy. It's not about the relaxant. It's about the context around the pregnancy. And it has to do with things like, what was the state of your nervous system in when you got pregnant? What is kind of like your backstory and some of the signature in your nervous system, right? Why is it that now you're pregnant and now there are a lot of your systems kind of on overload at this time? Mm-hmm. Some of the buffering capacity in your system is taken up a little bit by some of the demands of the pregnancy, right? So what else was kind of going on that now you have a bit of a protective response in your pelvic floor? And I mean, when we see this happens a lot more often the second pregnancy, we also see another risk factor is a previous trauma. And unfortunately, we see that a high, high proportion of women feel traumatized through their first birth, you know? So, I mean, that now is kind of unpacking as a really important sort of conduit for this issue. And then, you know, the individual is pregnant again, their whole system's like, uh-oh, here we go again, right? Because it very much is about sort of your innate protection mechanisms and your nervous system. And it's really a lot of the same psychophysiology that we see in other forms of persistent pain, quite frankly. It's just this area, it always wants to be handled through the perspective of biomechanics. And anyway, it's to the detriment. But really, that is how I explain to mamas. This is not sort of a mechanical issue. Another little trick that can help too is walking and walking backwards. So, you know, most women who have this issue, and to be fair, it can feel very mechanical because they'll say, well, no, like it hurts when I'm walking, I turn over in bed, I'm doing these specific mechanical movements, and I get that pain. It kind of seems like it's in a consistent place, right? And so that's going to kind of confirm the beliefs they already had, understandably. But then I'll say, okay, so given that the data would suggest that it isn't mechanical, you know, let's test out a few things. I want you to walk forward in my office, and now I want you to walk backwards. And sure enough, as soon as they walk backwards, it doesn't hurt because the brain's not anticipating something dangerous to happen and all the bit that sort of snowballs with how pain works and how that whole experience works. And sometimes those experiences are really important for people to almost then sort of question and poke holes in their own beliefs that they'll say, yeah, you're right. So I'll say, well, it was the same amount of weight. It had to load transfer through your pelvis, but it didn't hurt. And the reason why is because it isn't a load transfer issue. It's not a structural issue. It's these other things. And I think once you get really good at explaining, you know, the psychophysiology to people, they start to get it, especially if you can kind of poke holes in the theory. But more of us need to kind of have the same narrative. And that is also a problem. I see clients who, you know, their chiropractor has told them that they're having pain because of instability, or this is out of place, or this is twisted. Yeah. And now their midwife has said, oh, well, this is something you're just going to have to put up with. And then once you birth your baby, it should go away. And we have these ongoing narratives that are just really unhelpful and frankly not true.
Okay, so about 4 minutes ago, you said one of the most interesting things that, and you partially answered this, so I had to figure out a counter question that you didn't already answer, but one of the most interesting things anybody's ever said on this podcast, you had said that we see this as an issue more in the second baby and not the first, and I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's incredible, and part of what you talked about shortly after that is that the example that you gave was people having a traumatic
first birth.
Mm-hmm. I have to imagine that there's people that do not have a traumatic first birth that also have this issue in the second. And then what are some of the things that you talk to, or what path do you go down, or what is some of the logic that you help explain to them, where that's not the case? I'm honest to goodness, that's like one of the most fascinating things I've heard is the second. It makes sense the way you explained it, but what are some other instances where maybe they didn't have a traumatic first birth?
Yep, absolutely. So I'll give you an example. So through COVID, most of my care switched to virtual care, right? And through that time also, I mean, it wasn't exactly like the time that everyone was feeling the safest in the world, right? It wasn't like the happiest time for everyone. So I was seeing like a lot of clients, and I was finding a lot more clients that I was seeing were having this issue, but exactly what you said. They didn't have the traumatic first birth. They didn't have a miscarriage between the first time and the second time. They didn't have fertility treatments now to try to get the second one. Like there's lots of reasons why there can be a bit of trauma and an uptick before that second one. But, and they would often attribute their issue to that they were sitting more, because this is what people like to do. People like to attribute back pain and pelvic pain to a weak core and too much sitting, when it isn't that at all. And so they would say, well, you know, like I'm a teacher, but I'm doing like virtual learning and I'm sitting more and I'm not in as good of shape since my last pregnancy. Like my core was stronger before my first one, and people have all sorts of issues. And I'll say, okay, like that's, I'm hearing you, and I'm hearing you saying like, those are the things that you think are related. The data would say that it's quite unlikely, actually, those are the reasons. But that's not to say they aren't at all for any one person, right? But let's go through the things that make it more likely. You know, what's the morale been like in your job? You know, what is your sort of energy like? Like, how great has your sleep been now that you're caring for a child? You're kind of doing your job, the morale's down, and I'll start to go through the other established factors. And they're like, yeah, work's been really stressful. Like the morale has not been good. My energy is not great. You know, I actually like really have not gotten into a great sleeping pattern. And we'll start hitting the physiologic things. And I'll say, so the data would kind of say that those are much more likely at the root of why your system is more protective right now, and why your tissues are so sensitive. And they're kind of assuming that something's a problem when it's not really a problem. And I'll sometimes give them the example of, look, it's almost like you have your smoke alarm and it's just more sensitive. So like it's going off when you've just made toast and it shouldn't, right? It's kind of when we've taken up all our buffering capacity in our system, this is what happens. And your energy system is another system. And when we're stressed and we don't have good sense of purpose and good sense of like connection, that's kind of like gets us on this tick and it's metabolically demanding and it shortens our reserves, right? So it's another reason why our system can get more protective, you know? So that's another big, I would say, like basket of people of why it's more prevalent the second time around.
What are some, as a physio, what are some, so like I had reconstructive shoulder surgery years and years and years ago, and I would go and do my post-surgical rehab and all that kind of stuff. They kind of give me the list of at-home exercises or whatever to do. And that was kind of like my prescription for the next few months was to do that kind of stuff. Yeah. You have somebody that comes in, you've identified that this is a mind-body issue. You're certain about it. What are they walking out with as a prescription of, here, Dr. DeFour gave me these things to do. What are they?
So first of all, they have to understand, and that literally is my goal, is by the end of our first appointment together, and I actually still continue to do a lot of my initial consults virtually. I see people from all around the world. And my goal used to be as a physio to kind of get through my assessment form and kind of get through like chatting with the client. And then I had my little agenda of all the specific things I wanted to do. Yeah. And of course, I don't practice that way anymore at all, because that doesn't work for when people are in pain, and pain is such a multi-dimensional, you know, construct and experience. It doesn't work to care for people that way. So literally my goal by the time I'm done with someone is I want to make sure they understand why they're having their pain experience, that they would be able to explain to someone in their life in a few sentences what actually was going on in their body. And then they had a good sense of a bit of a menu of options of different things they can start to do to get the train back on the tracks. So it isn't very prescriptive, actually. You know, there usually are multiple different things kind of driving up systemic information that are kind of like compromising the energy system. We unpack and oftentimes detect previous traumas, not all the time, but we sometimes do. So we want to kind of be hitting all those bases. We also have to help people to understand that when your system is in that state, that isn't the time to kind of do regular sort of fitness training and conditioning. The system generally needs much more restorative movement, just with a different intention. So really, I want people to understand what the experience actually is, have a clear sort of understanding of why for them has this surfaced, why is their system overprotective right now, and what are some of the different things that we're going to want to target to wind it back down. And it'll help them kind of prioritize those things. But then it's sort of more up to them in terms of which things they think they can start with first. And then usually, you know, they start implementing these things and we get dramatic change quite quickly, actually. So that's essentially what it looks like. And movement is always part of it. Like people need to move. And that's why it's so important that people can't fear movement. And if people think that this thing has to do with a structural integrity problem, they will fear moving. Right? So we need to nip that in the bud like immediately, because movement is always a piece of this, but like sleep hygiene is a piece, and like really good anti-inflammatory nutrition is usually a piece, and thinking about the stress response system is usually a piece. Like there's different pieces.
That's another instance where you stole the thunder right out of my mouth before I could even say it, but that's not, that means we're on the same wavelength. That's not bad. Okay. Literally my next question was going to be, this podcast is called the Mind and Fitness Podcast. So you tuned in on that. So a lot of the people that come to me and ask me questions are people that are athletes in recovery, I guess you could say it that way. But people that were, like for me, I was a competitive weightlifter, and then I kind of had a whole litany of problems and diagnoses and all sorts of different things. And I completely left my sport and then was able to go back to it. There's a lot of people in that exact same situation, or they haven't gone back because they do have the fear of the movement. And one of the things that I talk to them about, and I don't do this for a living, like I have a day job. This podcast is it's a labor of love and it's fun. And it allows me to act like I'm a radio host, and it is what it is. But one of the things that I talk to them about as a prescription to me, for me, because again, I'm not speaking from a level of expertise. I'm just speaking from a level of experience that I have, is that I went from doing nothing to doing all the things literally over a couple of day span. Now that's counter to what you were talking about. Do you mind going a little bit further into not re-entering intense fitness training at such a rapid pace? Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're quite right that everyone is a little bit different. So part of my assessment strategy is I do something I call it profiling. So there's different sort of psychometrically sound questionnaires that are designed to pick up different things. So one of the ones I use with every single client actually is called the Central Sensitization Inventory. So it's a series of a number of questions. I usually start off with the short form version, which is only 9 questions. And it gives me a bit of an idea of like how wound up the nervous system is. So for people who scored quite high on that, then I really would want to be suggesting that they are taking a little bit more of like a graded approach and doing kind of much more sort of restorative exercises to start. But you can have someone who kind of has been like on and off in a bit of persisting pain and kind of like in and out of their sport, but they don't necessarily score high on that. And it's kind of other things. Maybe it's honestly more fear related and it's other things. So once they get over that, it literally can be like a switch. Like it can be a bit of like a mind over matter. So it's why I profile. So there's the fear avoidance belief questionnaire that I use. There's the pain catastrophizing scale that I use. There's the central sensitization inventory I use. So I use a couple of these different questionnaires, honestly, so I can better profile people. And then I can kind of guide them that way.
The central sensitization inventory. God, I can't believe I said that cleanly.
That was very good.
is that a standardization or did you come up with that?
Nope, it's a standardization. And honestly, it's something I teach like family docs about. I think if we were using this more honestly in primary care, we'd be addressing even just like standard non-specific lower back pain better, because even that is usually not a structural issue.
Yeah.
That usually has more to do with kind of what we're talking about as well. So no, that is a psychometrically sound, well-established. They have the long form version, which is 24 questions, and then a high score is anything over 40. And then they have the short form version, which is only 9 questions, and anything over a score of 20, you're in a state of central sensitization.
Okay, so I was about to say, I'm gonna Google it and I'm gonna read some of these, but it's on Physiopedia and I need to be a member in order to log in and do it. Do you mind just giving a couple of example questions?
Yeah, I don't mind at all. Yeah. So every single question you have to respond with never, rarely, sometimes, often, or always. Never is a score of 0, and then always is a score of 4, and then everything else is in between, and you're trying to come up with a score at the end. So one of the questions on the short form version is, I feel refreshed when I wake up in the morning. And then they have to answer never, rarely, sometimes, often, or always. Another question is, I have sensitivity to bright light. Never, rarely, sometimes, often, or always. Another one is, I feel achy and tension in my shoulders, right? Never, rarely, sometimes, often, or always. There's another question about pain in the jaw, right? Never, rarely. So really, it's all these questions that are different facets of what we see in central sensitization. So if we think of the different diagnoses that fall under that umbrella, you know, we have migraines, fibromyalgia, IBS, right? Persistent painful periods. There's a whole list of things that are actual central sensitization diagnoses. And really the individual questions on this questionnaire are the types of questions that people with these labels, they have all those things, right? So it's a way of like, forget about the labels. I'm not a label person. I generally find labels aren't particularly helpful. But it's to help people understand, yeah, it's not a coincidence that you're feeling anxious. You're also sort of sensitive to light. You get headaches sometimes. Like the fact that you have all this, that's part of this sensitivity in your pelvis. Like I'm helping people to kind of connect the dots a bit so they can kind of see they don't have all these random separate issues. It's almost like the analogy of a house plant. Mm-hmm. But I say like, look, like you're thinking your headaches is like this one leaf that's gone brown. And now this pelvic pain is this other one. And you feeling anxious is this one. And then your painful periods is this one. But what I'm telling you is that actually it's just, we got to get the soil better and all those things will go away. Right.
It oddly of all, what a weird transition. It oddly reminds me of my wife's shopping new cars right now. And mm-hmm. I had a Subaru several years ago that was brand new and it had blown three transmissions within a span of like a very minimal amount of time. And I kept going to them every time they would replace it under warranty. And I'd be like, are we sure this isn't like, there's like a bigger problem or what are the, and lots of other stuff was going wrong too, kind of. And I'm like, could this be one sort of central problem, or is it possible that all of these teeny tiny things and the transmission are all blowing over and over again, or is there maybe a bigger problem here?
Right.
That's what it reminds me of.
Exactly that. It's exactly kind of that concept, which for a lot of people actually makes things feel a little bit simpler.
Yeah.
And another thing I think is helpful for people to understand is to say, look, like the fact that your system is so sensitive, your system is actually not doing anything wrong, because a lot of people feel like their body has kind of failed them. It's gone rogue and there's a lot of shame attached to that. It's saying your body is adapting from a psychophysiologic perspective the exact way it's supposed to.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be bombarded with all the things you've been exposed to. So it's doing what it's supposed to do. So we need to understand it. We need to not be afraid. We need to get curious. We need to feel empowered. We need to put different inputs in, and then we can get everything better. So it's really trying to like simplify it for people, but like empower them. Yeah.
We're coming up on the last 5 minutes I promised you. One thing. So I did find a copy of this inventory. Question 24 on here is something I want some perspective on, because this has been as delightful as an interview as I could have ever hoped. So question 24, because this is such a subjective thing. And my wife and I just had sort of this conversation a few days ago, because I won't go into details. It's actually going to be, by the time that people hear this, actually, I will have told the whole story on the podcast. There was a fairly significant traumatic event that happened to our entire family last week. We're all safe. We're all fine. But there was a good 4 or 5 minutes where we did not think that that was going to be the case. The next day, and she had childhood trauma, significant. Mm-hmm. She had said the next day that she's sort of in the mode of diminishing the experience that we just had. Like maybe it wasn't really that bad. And this question 24, I suffered trauma as a child, never, rarely, sometimes, often, or always. Mm-hmm. Because trauma is so subjective as a child, I feel like there's a chance you could get people that, not a chance, almost a certainty, you may get people that you work with that question comes up and they will sort of think like, regardless of what they had going on as a kid, they may sort of diminish their own experience and say this, this X, Y, and Z happened to me, but it wasn't that bad. Other people have it worse. Can you talk about the subjectivity of trauma with what you do and how some of that conversation relates back to the work you do?
Absolutely. So, cause, and I think this is an important place for us to end off, because it is important. So first of all, I would say that the ACEs, the adverse childhood events research, and now there's a questionnaire on that, is highly, highly linked to persistent pain. So that's a very established correlation. Okay. So that's one thing. So it's important. I think that that's on our radar. We understand about how protective systems can get primed, et cetera. So the reason why this question made it onto this inventory actually comes from that. You are quite right. How trauma kind of lands on someone depends on a lot of different things. It depends on how much resilience that person actually had at the time of the trauma to kind of potentially dissipate the trauma. It depends on their own coping mechanisms, maybe like an avoidance or a diminished. And over time, yes, that can change for sure. So are we convinced we're getting an exact accurate? Well, no, but one of the things that it does do, and this is like one of the ways I use this question isn't in the short form version, by the way, though, is it gives me an opportunity, because I'll ask that question. And then usually before they even answer, I'll say the reason why this question is on here. So it gives me an opportunity to help them to understand that your experiences as a child and in your nervous system actually do color how your nervous system is going to respond to things down the road. So it can at least be a little bit of like awareness raising and food for thought. And they might say, oh yeah, no, I never really, really did. And even some people who did, they might feel shameful to disclose that even, right? But at the very least, now you've got them thinking a bit of all of these other kind of potential drivers that are making the soil not very good,
yeah,
that are potentially contributing to these problems. So it's still worthwhile, even though we're not necessarily convinced we're going to get an accurate answer, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was about as fast of a 30 minutes as there could be. But hang on the line just for a second. As I'm going to act like the interview's over and, you know, but then I want to chat for a second offline. Anything else? And where can people find more about you also?
Yeah, absolutely. So my clinical practice is through a place called The Womb, the world of my baby. So we have 6 different centers in Ontario in Canada, and I run my practice out of the Burlington site. As I said, a lot of my care is virtual, so I do see people from all around the world. So you can find me at The Womb. And then you can also find me at my McMaster Experts page, and that has all of my research and publications and kind of everything I've done. I've done a lot of research in this area too. So those are probably the best 2 places to find me.
Awesome. I will link those in the show notes. Dr. DeFore, thank you so much for being here. Like I said, hang on for a second, but this is where the interview will end. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.